Succession number 29703, Reel 2.
You haven't even got papers to show that you're Mr. So-and-so. But you still had to have it handy because you had to pay out money. They didn't give it to you for just for the fun of it. Buy cigarettes, no. You had expenses to pay. Well, it was a problem to get robbed of your money. It was a problem to keep it handy. It was a problem to distribute the damn thing. And it was a big problem not to give too much money to the same people. Because the first damn thing, the last thing they told me when I left England, Lucien, don't spare the money. And don't keep accounts. What the hell? And you know the best part of that, when I come out of the whole damn thing, a brigadier, I don't know what his name now, in his kilt, I was called in after the whole show was over. Lucien, what did you do with the money? What the hell? What did I do with the money? I spent it. I had 750,000 left and I handed it over to the office over there in Paris. So what? You want me to give accounts now? I don't know what the hell I did with the money. So, well, this is giving you an idea anyway about the trouble.
Well, you can see there were more than the human problems in this business. Anyway, let's have a look at the airman who is now on the ground and he has got rid of his parachute and is looking for help. Obviously, he would seek help, and I believe that he was told to approach only one person at a time and at either dusk or dawn and to look for clergymen and people like that. But I'm interested to know, did the escape organizations, the well-organized ones, actually look for airmen who they knew had come down? I wonder, Madame, if you can tell us if you actually had people who went out and looked for these airmen.
Yes.
And when you found them, what was the next move? What did you do with them and tell them to do?
Well, we knew where they fell down because we knew where the attack was. And we knew that from there on, the men, what you call, what they call Salem Charlie, were caught. That was really the people, the plane that they were looking for. It was the Salem Charlie. And we knew that when they fell down, it was always in a certain part of Belgium where all the German defense were. And we had contacts in every province in Belgium where we had people who didn't do anything else, but who looked after these men. And I must say that I'm very, very concerned about all these people out in the country. Generally, they were the peasants, and they were the first people who really helped us, because they used to get the men out from out of the woods or whatever, wherever it was always outside a town. And they would give them the first help, they would give them the first food, the first shoes, the first clothes, and they, I must say, they were really the people who did the hardest work of all. It was getting the men out of that area, getting them in civilian clothes.
Well, how did they know how to, for example, say an airman arrives on some peasant's holding, and the peasant, being a brave fellow, because he knows that he can be shot by the Germans for helping escaping airmen, he hides him in his barn or in a field of corn. Well, how did he contact the escape lines? Was it generally known that escape lines were in existence, or did he just ask around? I wonder how the contact was made with you good people in Comet, for example.
Well, we had generally these people who got these men generally went to the priest, to the church, and the priest generally knew always someone who knew someone who knew somebody who was helping, and we used to get them like that. It was, of course, just luck for the man who bailed out, because he didn't know if he was going to meet a friend. That was just his luck.
Thank you. Mr. Atkinson, was it like that with you? Were people brought to you, or did you send people out to find people? How did you come in contact with the people who were escaping, or how did the organization that you were concerned with locate Allied Airmen?
Well, your question is how I knew that there was a network
Well, no, how did you know, how did you make contact with an airman who was down in the area? For example, suppose an airman had parachuted into an area. Did you good people go out and try and find him?
Yes. I followed exactly what Sam and Mrs. Rosenman. We had people who knew that airplane had been shot down, you see. So having been shot down, we can expect to found airmen. So we have usually people used to travel in the country, you see, not stranger. We could visit the farm and locate the airmen. And the first step was to be sure that it was an airman and to let him where he was, you see. And they reported to us, and then we can act. But we acted only when the German were calm, you see, when they returned to their barrack, not searching in all the farms, you see. And sometimes we have to wait long because they were searching other plants or other plants fallen, you see. We have very hard sequences where we have first one night a plan and the second night three plans for them. So we have to let the thing being calm. See. And after we came and we removed the airman, if you have a place to put him, but sometimes he was very well where he was, because in a farm he can be fed. See. Some were wanted to, and we had to found doctor. And there are two sequences, you see. The sequences when all is going well, and the sequences when all is going wrong, you see. I think Mr. Dumay know better than me that when it went wrong, it is chiefly when we cannot anymore send airmen by the common line and improve.
Well, thank you very much. We'll come to things going wrong in a minute. And obviously, the thought occurs to me, what happened when you had a German infiltrator? Because obviously, the Germans were aware of what was going on to a certain degree, and they must have infiltrated imposters into the escape line.
Yes.
Now, how did you good people deal with such a person? Well, first of all, how did you check out an airman as being a genuine fellow from the U.S. of A.?
I could say that at the beginning, the Germans were kicking, you see. they had a way that the airman had not. And if the German was planted and he was very clever, he had to report. And I have a case of a helper warning me that their airmen were going out during the night. So I had the house watched, and at midnight he go very quietly, and there was a German car waiting him, and he returned at the end of the night. So he disappeared.
So you knew he was an imposter.
Yeah.
Mr. Dumay, I'm sure you must have some experience of how these people were vetted. Obviously, you had to vet every airman to see that he was a genuine airman and not somebody who'd been infiltrated into the lines.
Yes, we had ways of checking. Of course, we always had the last resort of sending his name and number over to England, but that took a long time. We certainly had not time to fool around with every airman coming around, because they were coming out thick and fast. Gee whiz, we thought the old American army and the British on top were coming down on top of us, because they were sure plenty of them. But the first thing, of course, is a question about that. And they usually came in twos and threes and more. So, of course, you can always check from the one to the other. See? If so-and-so was in the plane, who was with you? Except if he's a fighter pilot. But, there were seven or eight other men. If they were British, there were four others anyway. And check with the others. If you didn't have that, you could always ask him, sure good questions, you know, like, what was the last film you saw in England? Aha, already. Now, where was your station? Where did you dance in London when you went out on leave and so on? Well, you can think that the questions like that, they got stuck with us. Well, I can tell you of one fellow who came right around. He had a good story, a very good story. We didn't believe him too much. And the interrogator was a French girl. He was an English teacher in the University of Paris. And, of course, he could interrogate. And she had a chap who was supposed to be Norwegian. And his story was that he had been in Norway and had sailed across with his two brothers into England. And then they shipped them off to the United States, Boston, because it already started the radio work. So he went back to England after that, and the first night out, he was put on board a plane with a Lieutenant Lewis or something like that. Woods, it was, yes. The pilot was Lieutenant Woods, and he didn't know a damn thing about the number of planes was or anything like that. Well, that was a funny story, wasn't it? And so I was warned about this, and I went over to question myself. And I threw a few questions about different things to him, and I found out he was leery as hell. And I thought to myself, you bastard, you're not going to get away with this. So I told the two airmen who were in the place with him, watch him. I gave him a pistol, watch this guy. Because he was only 21 years old or so, and when I got finished, I didn't get finished in a half an hour, he was like this, you know. He knew his goose was cooked, and I couldn't leave him like that. So I thought, oh, never mind, fella, everything's going to be all right. We'll have you over in England in less than no time. And in the meantime, I got the radio operator to send off a message to London, check on so-and-so. His brother was a sergeant in the Royal Tank Corps in Africa. His other brother is somewhere in Welsh, in Wales, that is, and he's supposed to be, but he can't give the name of plane, the number of plane or anything like that, so check on him with the Americans. So they checked on him, the next day came the message. We had to move fast, and we did. And the thing was, this is not an American airman, nor a Norwegian, and get rid of him fast. So I said, well, this is really a queer, I better take you. Disposition fell. Well, I asked them to check over again, and they came right back. Get rid of him, quick, before you're in trouble. Well, we had no more trouble with him in 3 days' time. He stopped living.
Questionnaires, and they filled them up also. It was very good for us to be able to check with this questionnaire if they had bailed out and there were four or five of them or two who were of the same crew. You could go then to the other crew, the crew member, and ask him, is this right? And then you found out that you really had a real airman. And I think personally that was the most. The only people that we were worried about were those, what did you call them?
The fighter pilots.
Fighter pilots, single pilots, because they couldn't give you anything at all, and you really had to count on what they said.
Did you ever encounter any German agents?
No, I did not. I was one day supposed to go and interrogate one. But he disappeared before I got there. Luckily for me, because I don't know what I would have done with him.
Mr. Oderkirchen, did you have any experience with this?
Yes. Well, not supposing that they were American men or Englishmen, but they said there were French prisoners for, and that was very difficult. And then we had to shoot them in the woods. That was all we could do, and quickly. Mm-hmm. They came back from Belgium. They said they had to come back through the lines because they couldn't, the comet wouldn't accept them. They didn't know the name, of course. And then we took them in the woods. I haven't shot them, so I know when the man who shot them is dead.
Yes. Do you reckon that many of the helpers who were in fact caught by the Germans were caught through these sort of infiltrators?
Not much by these infiltrators. I don't know, not in the little part of the line I represented, but I know that it was very dangerous. It could happen, of course.
Yes. Did you know of anybody who was caught through that type
of
activity?
A whole family, the Maréchal family. And they were supposed to have been checked. These two men who came as airmen, they were supposed to be checked. And they were not. And they managed to get into the house of this lady. And she thought that they had gone through the checking part. So she accepted them. And they told her that they were American airmen. And they had bailed out. And they explained all their things. And she was absolutely sure that they were. They spoke absolutely like... Amazing. And when her daughter came back and she told her daughter that she had these two men, she said, "But were they checked?" And as the girl came in, the two men got up and they said, "Madame, the game is up." And they were all taken, and the father was shot in Germany. The whole family went to Germany. And the father was shot in Germany, the son, and also someone who came through the door, because you know the Germans always... when they picked anyone up, they always left one agent in the house. And just lights out and everything. And anyone who came to that house afterwards would be picked up, interrogated, and sent to Saint-Gilles, because they always knew that it was a friend.
Well, that shows just how dangerous helping an Allied airman was. Ralph, have you any comments on this particular subject?
I'd like to tell a story about my friend here. I happened to have been in the small town of Gangong, which was about 25 kilometers from the coast, and they came in one night, two Frenchmen, and listened to the BBC. And they heard on the BBC the code word, "Bonjour à tout le monde de la maison d'Alphonse," which is good evening to everyone in the house of Alphonse. Well, the mission is on. Get in the truck. So I get in the truck with my bombardier, and away we go. We get to the house of Alphonse, which is in the coast, and my first introduction to Captain Harrison, the British Military Intelligence Service. And Captain Harrison says, "We have too many here tonight. You two shouldn't be here." Well, now, here we are. There are 26 of us, and there are only supposed to be 24. And he's got two extra guys. He doesn't know how he got there. So the interrogation went sort of like this. "When do you wear anklets?" What do you say to that? Where do you wear epaulets? Where'd you leave the U.S.? What was your group number? And some guy in the rear pops up and he says, "I'm the ranking officer here," and he says, "You don't have to answer that question." DeMay turns around and he says, he's got a big 45, you know, and it's about that big. He says, "You shut up." He says, "This guy's going back to England. He may have a hole in his belly, but he's going back." And that's a true story. And Bill Spinning and Bob Locke were there at the time.
I'd like to come back on the other question previous to that. He's starting to make me tough. That's an awful plum. Identification. In Gangong, the swing into the house where I'm, two men, dark complexion. They're from India. Speak a little French, two words of English, and they're escaped prisoners. They tell me a story. They were in a mule transport at the beginning of the war. They were captured and escaped and so on. Here they are, 25 miles from the coast. And how the hell do you identify fellows like that? Quite simple. You just watch this. I had to take a few minutes off to think about this. Now, they're Indian. They were in the British Army. They had to understand English. So, let's see. Now, there were soldiers in the British Army. Let's check them. I took one outside, the other one, see there. Attention! Right turn! Oh, proper right turn. And so on. I go through the manual, not the manual, something like that. So, what the heck? If he's been a British soldier for 8 years. And I bring the other fellow in and give him broomstick. All right, come to attention. Soap arm. He soap arm. Order arm. Present arm. As simple as that. So, they were all right away.
Well, that's a lovely illustration. Well, having got the evading airmen in contact with the helpers, what happened next? Were they conducted to so-called safe houses and held there for a time, or were they transported immediately to various parts of occupied country? I wonder if anyone can tell us about that, how people were transported, because that must have been a very dangerous job. And the other thing that interests me, were they disguised in civilian clothes? Now, who should we start with? Let's start with you, madame.
Well, generally, when we had them in Brussels, they were already in civilian clothes, as I told you. They had some kind of false papers. They were not very good, but still they were sometimes kind of good. The moment we received them, then we had houses. We had two or three houses always ready to get them in. They got into these houses, and while they were there, they were being watched so that they would not go out. And then we had false identity cards made and given them a false identity card. From then on, you got hold of a guide. You were in contact generally with a guide who took them down further down to Paris, as it happened. You took them down to Paris. In Paris, when they crossed the border, soon they crossed the French and Belgian border, then they were given French identity cards. And from then on, they were taken on by the French side. Then they were taken to Paris, and there were always houses all ready for them. They were taken down there, and they went on from one place to another. They just made like jumps, you know, from one place to another.
Well, what sort of civilian clothes? I mean, was it best to dress them as workmen, and what happened?
That was a very, very touchy question, because, you know, in Belgium, we're small. And you people, you come like that. So, you are well fed. We are not. And you look, you Americans, you look very well in good health. So that it was always very difficult to get clothes for the men. But I personally, I knew of a man who used to buy, and it's sad to say, buy the clothes from the Jewish people who were arrested and sent to Germany. And those clothes were sold by the Germans to these people who had the second-hand shop. And generally, they were very good clothes and very, very well adapted to the American time. And I used to go and get the clothes there for a long, long time, I guess, there. And then one day, this man said, well, you always come and get clothes for these men, but I never see these men. Would you mind coming with them? I said, well, I can't, because they're my family, and they're in Germany. They've been on slave labor down there, and they've been bombed out, and they asked me for clothes, and I'm sending them clothes. But then I had this man very well checked, and we found out that he was a collaborator. And I'm very sorry to say we had to do away with him, but I had no more clothes.
Well, we won't ask how he was done away with. But
no.
How about you, sir, at the end?
Well, I had a fiancé. My wife knows about it, don't worry. I had a fiancé in Hilversum, and she and her parents and other members of the family collect especially raincoats or in the winter overcoats and shoes, because when the pilots were sitting in the train or in the streetcar, they saw the shoes were from a prison or the real shoes wearing by civilians. So I got them, and I was lucky. I was a food business, so I had a car. And I took them to Limburg, and I distributed them to several people who had someone at home, and they could dress them up, and then I could take them with a good long coat and good shoes. And then they went to you. They were checked already. We had to do anything, just transport them. And as I said, it was lucky I had my car.
Thank you. What about the documents that they used? These must have been very difficult to forge, and am I not correct in thinking that identity photographs were needed? It must have been very difficult to obtain these. Perhaps, Mr. Dumais, you can tell us how this was done.
Well, a lot of the airmen had pictures, photographs. Some didn't have them, so we had special not only interrogators, but also photographers who go up to the place and take pictures of them, getting ready for shipping them out. Of course, they had to be certified before we'd do much else. And we had, well, to make a thing simple, we even bought out printing shop. We had a printer, and he was a specialist in making fake papers. So we bought him a shop so that he could have all the papers he needed and all that. We went through a lot of trouble to get these things straight out, you know. So he was in charge of making all the false papers in the world. In fact, he made some false ones for me because I had some false ones from England, of course. I still have them. I keep that sort of souvenir, see. But they also made the fake ones. But you had to go to Brittany on our work there, and you had, when you got to Brittany, 20 miles from the coast, you had to show papers because you were not allowed on the coast unless you resided there. So you had to have special passes and special papers and so on, with the special addresses and so on. So it was quite simple in France to get a lot of things done because everybody was putting their hands to it, you know. So we weren't short of help. What we were short of, people who keep their mouths closed.
We weren't short of money either.
Well, there's oh, no. Money, I didn't know what to do with it. You know something? I spent $16 million. Wow. And they got the bookkeeper onto me answering questions on money. And I told him, my orders were not accounting money. No, don't worry. Don't keep accounts and all this. And he says, you spent $16 million. Well, I don't know how. First of all, I remember I went away with $1.5 million. So he let me go on with it and came back. Said, how much money did you have when you left? I said, $1.5 million. He says, no, it's not true. You won't have 750,000.
Well, sure. I gather then that if you were pretty disheveled, perhaps dirty, as well as being deaf and dumb, people would less likely to take any notice of you. In other words, if you were smartly dressed, you were more likely to be invited to answer questions. Is that right?
No. We always tried to have the men, at that time you still had these collars that you buttoned on, we always gave the men a clean handkerchief and a clean collar so that whenever he was on the go, he could always change and look decent. The moment he started to look like a ragamuffin, I think that was very bad for him.
Oh, that's interesting. Have you any comments on that?
I want to tell you a little story about conveying. I heard a story from one of my helpers. He lives in Quebec now. He's a Frenchman, and he's moved in there. And he was a convoyeur, we call it. And he was told to report to Gare Montparnasse in Paris to take some airmen down to the coast, which is about 10-hour journey. And there were supposed to be 3 people conveying 7 airmen. And when he got to Gare Montparnasse, something had happened to the other 2 fellas, and he was alone. So he was stuck with 7 men. That's a lot of people on a train, 7 men. And he got off at a small station where he was supposed to get off, in Brittany, near Guingamp. And 7 airmen got off behind him. And there was nobody meeting him. There was supposed to be somebody at the station, but there was nobody there, nobody on the platform. And it was market day in this little town. So he went right through the town, and all the market people, with 7 big husky Americans falling behind, like the mother duck with her ducklings. They were awful ducklings to him, because they were just falling right along. What would he do now? He took them out in the outer side of town, hid them behind bushes. He thought about the whole damn thing. He was stuck with it. And nobody in the crowd, nobody had noticed this file of people going by. And what he had to get them 25 kilometers away from there, where he was supposed to work with them. And, he started asking questions at the cafe, and the first man he talked to was the owner of the cafe. And he listened to the story about the airman. Oh, I know. Je sais. C'est une affaire pour Léon. That's something for Léon. How the hell did that fellow who was supposed to know a damn thing 25 kilometers away, how did he know it was a fair further for us? He wasn't supposed to know, but he knew. Things were getting around. And with that sort of stuff, you weren't very safe. Anyway, the truck came along, picked them up, and everything was all right. But that's one of the things that shouldn't happen. They do.
Well, what about the poor fellows who'd been injured in battle or were injured when they landed, made their parachute descent, or got out of a crashed plane? Was there anything that could be done for them? Mr. Atkinson, did you ever have any experience of...